People talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe the fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a far dive key. If you don't love it, leave it. Wrote this song I'm singing, be warned. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a far dying key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warned. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. Of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, lots happening. This is Friday, the 6th of October, and we had a big announcement today from Ottawa. Our minister in charge of, Indian Affairs, but Indigenous Affairs and Northern Development, Dr. Caroline Bennett, announced some other huge giveaway. $750 million to perhaps 20,000, they say, survivors, but when we talk about survivors, we're not talking about, you know, some sort of a dreadful illness or a horrible accident or whatever. But these are Indian children who were picked up in the 1960s and 70s taken from their parents for adoption in non-native homes. There are about 20,000 of them. Sometimes they got cut off from their real family, sometimes not. So anyway, they've been bitching and moaning for some years about the big injustice. Now, it's a little more complicated. Children weren't snatched from their parents' arms, usually for no reason. Now, whether or not Children's Aid Society, Family Services, or Children's Aid, or whatever the name they might be using, were excessive is another question. They may well have been. At that time, especially in the 70s, it was very much an in thing to among the trendies to adopt a Native Indian, just like at another time. after the movie 101 Dalmatians, for a short period of time, all sorts of people wanted to have a Dalmatian dog. That turned out very poorly. Also, there were all sorts of puppy mills, and Dalmatians are not the easiest dog to live with. They're not all that good with children, for one thing. For a while, it was quite trendy, including one of our prime ministers, Jean Chrétien. He had adopted a native boy, and this didn't turn out well. The guy's been involved with, brushes with the law for much of his youth and adult life. In many cases, it was deemed that native families, because many of them were dysfunctional, with a lot of alcoholism, in some cases incest, drug abuse, were not fit to take care of the native children. Now, not in every case. I'm not denying that there might have been injustices done. But now, 30, 40 years later, and of course, everything is hyped up in politically correct drama. These are survivors. Well, come on, what was there to survive? It may not have been the most desirable situation. On the other hand, a problem then and now is, what is to be done with Indian children from dysfunctional families? I think the law should be incredibly reluctant to remove a child. That I certainly agree with. Although I don't think that's the point of this latest get down on our knees and apologize. So another apology, and $750 million to about 20,000 survivors. It will be worked out who gets how much. I don't think that's being even decided what the procedures will be. They will be compensated. Oh yes, and then $50 million more for you've got to have a bureaucracy. $50 million more for some sort of institute that will help heal. You know, all the nattering on about healing and trauma and so on. Many people have had tough childhoods, and there's much bemoaning that they were cut off from their native culture and so on. But in many cases, the Indian parents weren't very good parents. It's a vicious cycle. What I think governments will now have to do is they won't be able to remove a native child, even in a very abusive situation, unless they can place them with native people. But that's a problem, as with so many minorities. When it comes to taking care of their own, they're not very good. There wouldn't be, would not have been native children to adopt if there'd been more native parents or natives prepared to be foster parents or to adopt. This is another orgy of political correctness. Our country's being invaded. We had a Muslim ISIS terrorist attack in Edmonton last Saturday, but no, we've got to have yet another apology. One of these days, and this is something I think we should be demanding right off the bat, the time has come to demand an apology to all the European founding settler peoples for the fact that our political class has schemed, going back to 1965, to replace us by third world immigration. And we will be a minority by probably just a little bit before 2050. Now, if there's got to be an apology, maybe that would be one. And once again, the poor old Canadian taxpayer is on the hook. This time for, $750 million, plus $50 million more to fund this institute. So, 80% of $1 billion, over $1 billion, or almost $1 billion for this. You know, this retrospective, apologies and huge payouts, is a way of undermining our order today. Of saying, but really, basically, everything that came before was evil and rotten. The government's lawyers, up until just very recently, were fighting, were defending against a lawsuit in Ontario by a woman who had been sent to foster care and later rejoined her band, her Native Indian band, and is today the chief. You know, I think it's wrong to judge yesterday's actions by today's standards, because these standards today may well be wrong. But be that as it may, nobody is guaranteed a life without stress, or perhaps even a life without injustice. What is important is what we do today, for today. Anyway, yes, Canadians, or at least our government, it seems to be forever on their knees, apologizing to one minority or another for something or other. Well, somebody who ought to be doing some apologizing is a, it would appear to be a homosexual, wouldn't you know it, judge in Arkansas, Judge Joseph Boakman. And he apparently traded light sentences for nude photographs of various male defendants over a 30-year period on the bench in eastern Arkansas. Not looking good. A former Arkansas judge admitted Thursday in court that for years he gave lighter sentences to men guilty of minor crimes in return for nude photographs and sexual favors. In a misconduct case that a top legal discipline official called one of the worst in the state's history. Joseph Boakman had been set for trial this month, but pleaded guilty to wire fraud and witness tampering. Under terms of a plea bargain, he would face at least 2.5 years in prison, though U.S. District Judge Christine Baker isn't required to go along with that sentence. Federal prosecutors said they would drop 19 other charges after Boakman's sentencing, which will occur probably early in the new year. Boakman appeared in court yesterday and pleaded guilty. He's 71 years old. And as a district court judge in Cross County, about 100 miles east of Little Rock, Boakman mainly handled low-level offenses such as traffic tickets and misdemeanors. Dozens of men who had passed through his court accused the judge of misconduct dating to his time as a prosecutor decades ago. Some said they posed nude in exchange for money to pay their fines. Attorney Peter Halpern of the U.S. Department of Justice told Baker that, well, that's the judge, former Judge Boakman had arranged for a third party to threaten a man who had complained about the abuse to state investigators. Boakman admitted doing so on Thursday, that that's the witness tampering. So, you know, a complete betrayal of the integrity of the judiciary. According to Halpern, Boakman would typically offer men a sentence of community service in lieu of court fines and fees, picking up bottles and cans while Boakman took photographs. An investigation by the Associated Press into court and law enforcement records last year showed that of the 254 men Boakman sentenced to community service over a 7-year period, In one of three districts he oversaw, just 13 of the cases included timesheets
and court records showing completion of the sentences. So it seems that even these community service sentences were largely a fraud and illusion, and that the man did very little other than pose nude and perhaps perform sexual acts for the judge. Now, he's going to get 2.5 years. When you consider the horrific sentences handed out to white nationalists, you've got to see that the justice system is seriously compromised. Oh, from the sewer that spews forth what's loosely called entertainment, Jewish-dominated Hollyweird. Interesting story, right back to all the stories of the casting couches where these portly, pudgy little men, Jewish men from Eastern Europe, who were the casting directors and so on, and in the heyday of Hollywood in the 20s and 30s and 40s, would regularly require a potential an actress competing for a role to go to the casting couch, which is a nice way of saying have sex with them. Well, Harvey Weinstein, the larger-than-life Hollywood executive and Oscar winner, is taking a leave of absence from his own company after an explosive expose revealing decades of sexual harassment of women, from employees to actress Ashley Judd, was published yesterday in the New York Times. The article includes first-person accounts of Weinstein's alleged conduct, including from Ashley Judd, who recounts an incident from 2 decades ago in which she said she was asked to meet Weinstein in his hotel room. Weinstein greeted her wearing a bathrobe and asked her if she would give him a massage or watch him shower, the paper reported. Women have been talking about Harvey amongst ourselves for a long time, and it's simply beyond time to have the conversation publicly, Judd told the Times. Two company officials tell the Times that at least 8 women have received settlements from Weinstein over the years, including actress Rose McGowan, who allegedly had an incident with him in 1997 when she was 23. The New York Times said its investigation uncovered allegations against Weinstein stretching back nearly 3 decades, which it said it had documented through interviews with current and former employees and film industry workers, as well as legal records, emails, and internal office documents. Weinstein is taking a leave of absence. He's been a very powerful Hollywood figure for several decades. He's known for producing such films as Pulp Fiction, Goodwill Hunting, and Shakespeare in Love. And he won an Oscar for that latter one, and launched the careers of actresses and actors with his company Miramax. His often aggressive tactics were chronicled in Peter Biskin's book, Down and Dirty Pictures. Interesting. So yeah, these are the type of people who pump out what, as I say, is loosely called entertainment. Oh yes. big mistake, of course. Well, I shouldn't say a mistake. The result of government mistakes. Trans Canada Pipeline announced the death of the Eastern Pipeline yesterday. It is pulling out of the proposed project, which would have built onto pipeline that already goes from Alberta into Quebec, and would have extended it down to the port of St. John in New Brunswick, where a huge refinery was going to be built, and there would be refineries built along the way. This would allow Canada to refine a tremendous amount of the oil produced in Western Canada, And this is tremendous value added. It's one thing to export oil, but if you export gasoline, you have actually processed it. And and those are, high wage, good jobs. However, and you've got to understand, most of this pipeline, it was already built. The pipeline's there, it would have to be expanded, though, and then extended down to the port of St. John, New Brunswick. Not intrusive at all. However, radical environmentalists in Quebec and to some extent in Atlantic Canada and Ontario have complained. And under our just red tape choking system of hearings before the National Energy Board, various reviews and more. It has taken 5 years of consideration. Add to that that the government has now recently added more criteria that have to be reviewed. I hate that word. And that would be the downline and upline environmental impacts. Well, in some cases, what would be the downline environmental impacts? Does that mean when the gasoline gets to some foreign country, how will that affect their environment? Well, who knows? It would depend on the environment. It would depend on so many things. And why should it matter? Well, it matters if you want to stop the pipeline. If you are an energy hater, a car hater, a person who is an adherent of this scientifically bogus climate change religion. And it is a religion. And it frankly makes no sense. Up until very recently, the accusation was that there was global warming caused by hydrocarbons. When you burn gasoline or diesel fuel or coal or whatever. Well, there are a couple problems with that. Number one, it turns out, it may not be warming. In fact, there's strong reason to believe that we may actually be entering into a cooling period. There's a book that came out 40 years ago called The Coming Ice Age. Now, is there a coming ice age? Well, it's not certain. But regardless, hydrocarbons have virtually nothing to do with it. That's the big scam-rama. We're told that global warming was occurring because of hydrocarbons in the atmosphere. Now, at our meeting here in Edmonton, last night, where I spoke on Charlottesville, and I talked with Charlottesville, changes everything. I'll come back to that in a day or two. But anyway, at our meeting, we had a pretty free-ranging discussion. And after the meeting, one of the fellows there said to the guys that were sitting around the table, do any of you know what the percentage of carbon dioxide there is in the air? And one person guessed about 20%. Somebody else thought 50. The fact is, it's about 2%. And it's very, very good. Actually, plants, trees use carbon dioxide and transform it into food. It's good. It helps them live. But regardless, the story was, the assertion was, that global warming was caused by by increased levels of carbon dioxide in the air, which, of course, does not explain why there was a warming period in the 18th century, followed by a cooling period in the part of the 19th century. Why there was a warming around the year 900 or 1000 in the Middle Ages, which allowed the Vikings to move across the North Atlantic to Iceland, to the Faroe Islands, to Greenland, eventually to Canada, the Baffin Island, down to what's now Newfoundland and Labrador, and almost certainly into the Great Lakes. But that's another. So, and that period was then followed by a cooling period. Well, one of the intriguing things is, and you would think that the global warming argument would die quickly on this. One of the intriguing things is that there was virtually no hydrocarbons being generated by man in the around 800 or 900 AD, or again in the 18th century. Almost no coal being burned. There were no internal combustion engines, no gasoline, no diesel fuel, and so on. So why were these warming periods if it's man-generated hydrocarbons? You would think that would put an end to it, but there would have been a period of fanaticism. We've got to fight carbon emissions. So go for green energy, try to get away, do away with the internal combustion engine, punish people with carbon taxes for using gasoline and so on. But as it turned out, and now there aren't too many people that are now seeing the dangers of global warming. Okay, it's climate change. Well, you can't lose on that one. Climate is always changing. In fact, the history of the history of this Earth as we know it is one of constant climate change. It will warm up, it will cool off, warm up, cool off, warm up, then there's an ice age, warm up, and so on. But what does that have to do with hydrocarbons? You can't simultaneously say they're responsible for global warming, and they're not. But they're also responsible for global cooling. Oh, it doesn't matter. It's just a tax grab. Anyway, this endless harassment of our pipeline projects, and several have already been canceled, turned down by the government. This one was probably going to be approved, but the company in question. Trans-Canada Pipelines finally threw up its hands and said it's no longer economical. If we have to spend more years, and probably they've already spent $1 billion on this project, and nothing's yet being built, it's just not economical. And this is a catastrophe for the province of Alberta, which is the main oil producer. It's also a catastrophe for people in Eastern Canada who would have some great jobs, especially at the refinery in St. John, New Brunswick. And St. John is an area of chronic unemployment. This decision is sadly a victory for the environmental crazies and the Luddites, the ones who don't mind benefiting from this, modern world with transport trucks and cars and so on that give us the standard of living we have. But they don't want benefiting but they don't want it anywhere near them. The appalling mayor of Montreal, Denis Coderre, used to be our immigration minister back around 2003. He's now the mayor of Montreal, a truly disgusting figure, tweeted a big hooray for this this project. He thought that was all pretty good. A big hooray when it was canceled. This is shocking, and it's going to have a serious economic impact on Alberta, but on others as well.
one of the columnists for the National Post. I wrote a very good column on this, and I'm going to get to that right after a short musical interlude. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. And in this musical interlude, I'm going to play a singer I've played a few times before. I think he's real fine for me. So not all of his tunes are necessarily completely family friendly, but he has a strong voice and a real dedication to the cause of the South, to the Confederacy. And this is, I think, a really charming, emotional little ballad called Mr. Confederate Man. This is Rebel Son and Mr. Confederate Man.
I was just a little boy in elementary school. English and math and science class, learning the golden rule. I learned how to add and how to subtract, how to multiply and divide. I learned about bugs and I learned about plants and I learned how to read and write. But my most favorite class of all was my last class of the day, when my history teacher would tell us tales of old times long gone away. I was amazed at the way she knew all the people and their names and the places and the dates. That's when I first learned about General Lee and his 13 rebel states. One day she came to school with a big brown grocery bag. She opened it up, we all helped her hold up this great big X-shaped flag. She said, class, now only a fool will tell you this flag is a symbol of hate. It represents the men who fought and died with pride for our Confederate states. Your assignment tonight, I want you to write, I want you to pretend that one of these brave men came back to life. Now what would you say to him? Well, the school bell rang and I thought, as the bus carried me across town, I got out my pencil and my notebook pad, and this is what I wrote down. I wrote, Mr. Confederate Man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland, Mr. Confederate Man. The next day in history class, I put my paper on the teacher's desk. Then she called me up in front of everyone because she said she liked mine the best. As I walked up to the head of the class, my teacher smiled and she nodded at me. Then I saw a tear roll down her cheek as I began to read. I read, Mr. Confederate Man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland, Mr. Confederate Man. Well, I was at home reading through the news just the other day.
When I ran across my old teacher's name and I saw where she had passed away, with a bittersweet smile I looked up at my wall, a wrinkled paper in an old wood frame, where underneath pencil words almost faded away, she had marked a great big red A. Plus, Mr. Confederate Man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland. Mr. Confederate Man, I wrote, Mr. Confederate Man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland. Mr. Confederate Man.
And that's Rebel Son, Mr. Confederate Man. And here's another tune of his, Sitting Up Drinking with Robert E. Lee. Confederate Son. Well, that's a good song, but not there. This is not quite the song I'm wanting. Here we are, Sitting Up Drinking with Robert E. Lee.
Taking a trip in my old Chevy, riding through the South. I looked up on a hill and I saw a big white house. I caught a glimpse of a bearded man polishing his sword. Well, I saw Robert E. Lee outside sitting on the porch. I pulled up in the yard and saw a cotton field out back. He invited me to sit with him and share a fifth of Jack. He had crisscross bars and 13 stars blowing in the wind. He said, save your Confederate money, boy, cause the South will rise again. And Robert E. Lee did not like them Northerners one bit. He was a rebel and he knew it, and he didn't give a shit. We've been talking about Dixie and how old times used to be, and I've been sitting up drinking with Robert E. Lee. We talked about his troops and the rebel infantry, and those 13 southern states that live in infamy, as he took another swig of his black label whiskey. He said, that Yankee pride don't mean a damn thing to me. He spoke about his men and how they always fought so brave, and how they wove their sacred flag, though many lives they gave. He struggled to gain independence for his southern ground. He stood up for his cause and never once did he back down. And Robert E. Lee did not like them Northerners one bit. He was a rebel and he knew it, and he didn't give a shit. We've been talking about Dixie and how old times used to be, and I've been sitting up drinking with Robert E. Lee. Drink 'em up. thank him once again. But the lights were bare, there was nothing there but rotten dirt and sand. Was it my imagination playing with my head? I remember hearing clearly every single word he said. Every movement, every gesture, every tear that his heart shed. His dream is still alive, even though his body's dead. Robert E. Lee's memory lives on in the Southern soul, along with his boys who fought and died out in the cold. Lee was a man with tons of courage, a hero without a doubt. He was a man with determination, he was a man from the South. And Robert E. Lee did not like them Northerners one bit. He was a rebel and he knew it, and he didn't give a shit. He said, son, I have got many stories to tell. Ulysses S. Grant, kiss my ass and go to hell. We've been talking about Dixie and how old times used to be. I've been sitting up drinking with Robert E. Lee. Drink him up, bro.
Up drinking with Robert E. Lee, and that was Rebel Sun. I'm going to play one more tune for this musical interlude, and it got a little more of a religious theme, and this is Carl Jackson and his group, The Little Mountain Church.
Yeah.
There's a little mountain church in my thoughts of yesterday, where friends and family gathered for the Lord. There an old-fashioned preacher off the straight and narrow way, for what few coins a congregation could afford. Dressed in all our Sunday best, we sat on pews of solid oak, and I remember how our voices filled the air. Mama sounded like an angel on those high soprano notes of when the roll is called up yonder, I'll be there. Looking back now, that little mountain church house has become my life's cornerstone. It was there in that little mountain church house I first heard the word I based my life upon. All-day Sunday singings and dinner on the ground, many were the souls that were revived. While the brothers and the sisters who'd gone on to glory land slept in peace in the maple grove nearby. Looking back now, that little mountain church house has become my life's cornerstone. Was there in that little mountain church house I first heard the word I based my life upon. Looking back now, that little mountain church house has become my life's cornerstone. It was there in that little mountain church house I first heard the word I based my life upon. Thank you.
Carl Jackson and Little Mountain Church House. Back to the issue of the canceled Energy East pipeline, going to be a disaster for Canada. And this is from today's National Post by Claudia Capnell. The cancellation of Energy East is the last of the big nation-building pipelines decisions that resulted from Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's forced transition to greener energy. It's another area of the economy that Ottawa has badly mishandled. It's based on an energy model for Canada that is a lousy fit for our geography, history, economy, and the competencies and desires of its people, particularly in Western Canada. It's the reason Calgary, and that's where I am tonight, Calgary's economy is dead, where it should be humming, with new activity amid rebounding oil prices. And that unemployment in Alberta is so high, it's a national political embarrassment. Energy East died yesterday after Ottawa expanded its regulatory review to include climate change impacts of the whole upstream and downstream oil industry. Climate change impacts. Well, another cause for tens of millions of more dollars for lawyers and experts and reports and so on. Proponent TransCanada Corporation said it took the decision after a careful review of the changed circumstances. The changed circumstances is this is simply never going to get done. Or, you know, it'll be another 5 years. it expects to take an estimated $1 billion after-tax non-cash charge in its fourth quarter results. So it will show probably a loss for this quarter. $1 billion spent on preparing studies and reports, and you know, we are a country that is regulated to death. Natural Resources Minister Jim Carr insisted TransCanada pulled the plug because of business considerations influenced by the state of commodity prices. Yeah, but no, the price of oil is slightly going up again. That's not the reason. It's amazing how business conditions deteriorate when regulatory processes drag on forever, are changed to the detriment of the proponent, and hold no promise of fairness. As they say in the business, time kills all projects. While Energy East is over, the political outrage is just beginning, and the Canadian unity crisis is festering. Montreal's appalling, well, that's my word, not hers, Mayor Denis Coderre, who's running for re-election next month, rubbed salt on Alberta's wound by saying in a tweet he's very proud of the outcome. Very proud of something that will economically damage another part of the country, and his own part of the country, the silly fool. Alberta's NDP Premier Rachel Notley called the pipeline failure an unfortunate outcome for Canada, for Canadians. Our government has supported Energy East since the project was proposed, she said. Alberta United Conservative leadership candidate Brian Jean lamented the shameful moment in Canadian history. Eastern politicians like Denis Coderre take pride and credit in the cancellation of energy projects that would benefit the entire country. He's proud of holding back Canada's energy prosperity. Other provinces have declared war on Alberta. They're cheering for Canada to fail and threatening national unity. The political blockading of Canada's energy products is not acceptable and must be fought every step of the way. Deputy Federal Conservative Leader Lisa Raitt blamed the decision on Trudeau's disastrous energy policies. Energy East now joins a heap of failed Canadian energy projects. The Northern Gateway pipeline, proposed by Enbridge, was put out of its misery by Trudeau barely a year ago, so it wouldn't get federal approval. The $36 billion liquefied natural gas project led by Malaysia's Petronas perished this summer after years of being pushed around by regulators. They hadn't gotten the regulatory approval yet.
Let's not forget the mass exodus of international oil sands companies that found opportunities elsewhere, or the exodus of capital from Canada's own energy champions, including TransCanada and Enbridge, in favor of expansions in the United States. We can thank Trudeau's carbon tax and a red tape onslaught at a time of uncertain oil prices for that too. The Liberals are now this is a direct result of regulations gone crazy. And there will be a lot of people out west, especially in provinces like Alberta and British and Saskatchewan, who pay a lot of taxes for something called into the taxes for regional equity. These are transfers. So the idea is that there should be per capita the same amount of money raised by taxes to provide essential services like health care, etc., regardless of where you live. So under federal transfers, have not provinces or poor provinces, particularly like Quebec and New Brunswick, will get equalization payments from wealthier provinces like Alberta or British Columbia or Saskatchewan. Well, when Westerners, particularly in Alberta and Saskatchewan, see Eastern politicians cheering the cancellation of an energy project, believe me, a lot of people are a lot less happy about paying extra tax for equalization to help the have-not provinces, especially when one of the have-not provinces, particularly in this case the province of Quebec, or at least some of its political leadership, are blatantly cheering on the cancellation of this project that would have benefited them. I'm going to conclude with an item about former British Prime Minister Sir Edward Heath. Heath was always a red Tory. That is in England they call them the Wets. We call them perhaps country club Republicans, but not really conservative at all. He was Prime Minister from 1970 to 1974. He was no friend of the white population of Rhodesia. He was a homosexual, and there have been repeated rumors over the intervening 40 years of his predilection for young boys. In fact, there are significant parts of the British establishment, and there are reports on this all over the internet about the American establishment, and too, of pedophile rings. Well, there's been an investigation for the last little while into Sir Edward Heath. A controversial police investigation into former Prime Minister Edward Heath has become really quite controversial. Chief Constable Mike Veal of the Wiltshire Police, that's a county in England, said detectives drew no conclusions about the innocence or guilt of Heath, who was Prime Minister from 1970 to 1974. The police report on the investigation, codenamed Operation Conifer, that was released on Thursday, said there is sufficient suspicion to have interviewed Sir Edward Heath under criminal caution regarding his suspected involvement in child sexual abuse. Now, that's not the same thing as saying we have evidence he did it, because of course he was long since dead when this investigation started. And you have to listen carefully to what was said. There is sufficient suspicion to have interviewed Sir Edward Heath under criminal caution regarding his suspected involvement in child sexual abuse. Now, what that would mean is
he would be called in formally for an interview, and he would be cautioned, as in an American legal situation, what you say may be used in evidence against you. So in other words, this isn't just seeking general information. You are a suspect. Doesn't mean you've done it, did it, but police looked at 42 allegations and said there was sufficient suspicion to have questioned Heath about seven of them. So not every allegation was deemed credible. Heath, they included the alleged rape of an 11-year-old boy in London during a paid sexual encounter in private in a dwelling, and an alleged indecent assault on a 10-year-old boy. Another two of the seven claims related to paid sexual encounters. So these are seriously underage young boys, in some cases paid as prostitutes. And there are repeated stories, and in some cases actual charges laid against some important members of the British establishment about their pedophile behavior. This is, I think, very serious. Of course, Sir Edward Heath will never be charged with this. He died in 2005. There's a lot for some members of the British establishment to answer for. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on White Resistance Radio. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever, played by the 48th Highlanders. Thank you.